I'm going to jump right into a scene, which is part of the narrative that's told by prisoner of the Gestapo, who's writing her confession. So this is her talking. The guillotine had been used recently, blood still on the blade. We stood tied together mutely, and I thought, they will make me watch. They will kill her first, and they will make me watch. Then they will kill me. I knew she knew it, too. But, of course, she would not look at me or speak to me, though the backs of our hands were touching. I told her my name. She did not answer. They cut the cords that tied us together. They pulled her forward, and I did watch. I did not look away from her face. It was all I could do. She called out to me just before they pushed her into position on her knees there. My name is Marie.
Boy, that's a cliffhanger. I'm going to lose my audience there as they go running for their books.
I hope so. Hey, that section was actually suggested to me by my daughter, who was at the time 12. So. I feel like I need to credit her for it.
You know, that's interesting to bring that up. Your daughter, 12 at the time, and this is classified as a young adult novel. In fact, that's why we're talking about it. It's the book chosen for Commutine here in the Portage area. And I'm wondering what makes it young adult, because when I read it, I thought, there's no reason an adult wouldn't pick this book up.
Well, the reason that my agent gave when she was originally defending it was that I submitted it to her as a young adult novel. I'd always previously written young adult. And she then took it to a bunch of different publishers submitting it as a young adult novel, and they all published it as young adult, and nobody ever queried that. Hmm. So that's not really a good definition of young adult, and it doesn't tell you why this particular one is, but it clearly fit into that group of books. I've written about and talked about this a lot because it's a thorny question. Adults seem to query it more than teens. Teens eat it up. They just accept it for what it is.
Oh, I don't doubt that. Yeah.
Well, I think that the big difference between an adult novel and a young adult novel is that the characters in a young adult novel have changed by the end of the novel, and they don't have to change in an adult novel, but they're still growing, they're still learning, they're still figuring out how to make their way in the world. And I think that's really the thing that classifies young adult.
Well, gee, I hope all us adults do that, too, that we learn throughout life.
Well,
I'm giving you a tough time here.
That's why many young adult novels appeal to adults, because we're changing too. You know, we're not,
that's
not
a good
all
thing, because, you know, even though this book has been chosen here for the Commutine common read for teenagers, the adults shouldn't even think twice about picking it up and reading it. You may be grabbing it out of your kids' hands, in fact. And maybe one of the reasons that I thought about that was, and maybe you can give us a synopsis here of the book, there's a lot of graphic scenes of torture. This isn't a sweet book of, you know, a boy-girl romance or something. This is some pretty heavy stuff.
Well, first of all, I would jump on board and agree that it's not a sweet boy-girl romance. There really isn't any romance in it, and I think that young adult often has a bit of a reputation for just being romance. And there's lots of other things going on there, too. But this is much more a story of friendship.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of didn't realize that until I had written it. And then I went, oh, my gosh, you know, nobody writes about the fact of being friends. And that was really, despite the fact that it's a thriller, it's very much at its core a story about the friendship between these two girls. One is a ferry pilot during World War II, and the other is a spy who gets sent into Nazi-occupied Europe.
Kudos to you for not making it a romance. I think for young adults, I find that refreshing. Life isn't all about romance. It's about other things, too.
It's a hard book to outline because there's so many kind of exciting things that happen.
That's
that you don't
want
to know about.
That's why I'm making you do it.
But basically, it's about a young pilot. She's a pilot before the war, and she, during wartime, meets because she's signed up with the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, who support the Royal Air Force in Britain during World War II. Mm-hmm. And she meets another character who becomes the Verity of the title, and they become very good friends. And as the war goes on, they kind of find their roles, and Verity gets sent on more and more intriguing missions until finally she's sent to France. And Maddie, the pilot, is the woman who transports her. So she flies her to her various locations. Mm-hmm. And they crash land in France. They get shot at on their way in, and Verity has to parachute out, and Maddie crashes. So now they're both sort of stuck. Verity ends up being captured almost right away by the Gestapo, and Maddie is in hiding. And so really the whole book is about Maddie trying to rescue Verity and Verity trying to complete her mission, which you don't really find out to the end of the book.
And the narrators change, but at least initially it starts out with the girl who's been captured writing as a way to supposedly expose secrets to her captors, and she writes it like a novel.
That's right. She has been tortured. Actually, a lot of the torture happens off screen, happens off stage.
Yeah.
So she kind of hints at what has happened to her, but she's been tortured and has decided to give up, and is now confessing to everything she knows about the British war effort. And she chooses to write this confession in the form of a novel. She's got a very literary background, and she knows that she's doing this. And when her part is finished, Maddie takes over and tells the story kind of from another point of view, because obviously they're not together during that time in France. So both parts together complete the story, and you get a really different take on things depending on which character is talking.
Fair to call this historical fiction, yes?
Yeah, definitely. Although that's always been kind of a downer of a title. It's, you know, it's a historical thriller.
I'm fascinated always with these kind of books on the research and how much this is tethered to actual events. Talk to us a little bit about how you researched this story.
Okay. I actually kind of got the seed for this story from a visit to the Imperial War Museum in London, where there was an exhibit on called Women and War. And that was actually where I found out about the women who had gone into Nazi-occupied Europe as spies and saboteurs. And I really wanted to write about them. But I also wanted to write about the women who flew for the Air Transport Auxiliary. And I found out about them because I had written a short story about a girl who disguises herself as her dead brother so she can fly as a combat pilot. Because at the time, I didn't know that there were women who were actually flying in World War II during wartime. And it was doing research for that that, you know, kind of led me on. One thing led to another. And so from that initial museum trip, I then had to go and find books about the Air Transport Auxiliary and books about the Special Operations Executive, which was the organization that trained and supported the agents who went into Europe. And you know, again, one thing led to another. One of the things that I did to try to get the language right was I read a lot of books that were written during the time, during the 1930s and the 1940s. And I watched movies that were set during the time to give myself a feel for the language. And movies are actually, both books and movies are really interesting to do that kind of thing for, because you find all these little details that you wouldn't otherwise that wouldn't occur to you, you know. So if you kind of look in the background, you see what kind of files the people have in their office, and you see what kind of plates they're eating off, and, you know, you get a sense for their clothes and stuff like that. That is kind of more fun and probably more realistic than just looking up a book of, or looking up online what kind of clothes people wore during that time, because this is what they really were doing.
I understand that you read some survivor accounts.
Well, that was more for my the book that follows Codename Verity, which is called Rose Under Fire. And one of the things, when I was doing the research for the Special Operations Executive agent, what I really was very much aware of was that there was kind of another half to their story. So many of them, that they sent 39 of these women into France during World War II. And of those 39, 13 of them died. So a third of them were killed in action. And about a quarter of them, I think, ended up in concentration camps. Some of them died, some of them didn't. And about a fifth of them all ended up in the same women's concentration camp, which was Ravensbrück. And so Rose Under Fire is kind of like the second half of their story, what happens to them after they're sent to the concentration camp. So that was what I read the survivor accounts for. I read a lot. It's kind of weird because in my head, I don't actually know much about the concentration camp system in Europe during World War II. I know a lot about Ravensbrück. I know a lot about one camp, just as anyone who'd been there would only know about that one camp.
So the role of women in war back then, was it mostly to transport airplanes of different kinds? What was the typical role for women in World War II, I should say?
Yeah, part of what I really enjoyed doing while I was writing Codename Verity was actually just looking at lots of different roles that they played. So Codename Verity focuses on a woman or two women who are involved in the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. Those women did not actually fly. They were plotters, so they would map where enemy planes were coming in and where combat planes were going out. These weren't part of the Auxiliary Air Force, but some of them managed the balloons that they sent up to get in the way of enemy aircraft. Some of them worked on the land because there weren't men working there. They worked as wireless operators. They worked as radio operators. They did, you know, some more traditional jobs that we associate with women, such as they were cooks in the canteens, and they were, you know, they did laundry and they did stuff like that, and they worked as stenographers. But they basically could do anything, and there were roles for them. The only thing they couldn't do was work in combat. So the women who worked on anti-aircraft units could do everything except fire the guns by the end of the war. They weren't allowed to fire the guns. They didn't want to have women have killing on their conscience. That was something that only men should be able to do. So I was really kind of stunned to discover that there were so many of these different roles, because I was under the impression that I know, you know, that women helped out in traditionally male jobs on the home front, such as driving buses and you know, driving tractors and working in munitions factories, because the men were all at war. But I hadn't realized how much women were involved in the military, in the war effort itself. So that was something that I was kind of playing with in Codename Verity. As far as flying is concerned, in Britain, which is where Codename Verity is set, there was an organization that basically ferried aircraft to free up the Royal Air Force for combat, and that was the Air Transport Auxiliary. And there were about 1,000 civilians who participated in the Air Transport Auxiliary, and about 200 of them were women. So they were mostly men who, for whatever reason, couldn't join the Royal Air Force. They were too old, or they had some kind of disability. I think they had two different pilots who were each missing an arm. So it was a variety of people, but about a fifth of that organization were women, and they were paid equal pay with men as of 1943. They were the first British government organization to do that, which is, I think, pretty cool.
Yeah.
In other countries, they were actually the first organization to use women to fly planes in a military capacity in wartime. There were women who had flown in World War I, but only kind of under their own steam, as it were. The USA had a similar program, which people may have heard of, called the WASP, the Women's Air Service Pilots. And the difference is that the women who flew for the WASP did not get organized as quickly, and they were segregated. So they were, it was just a women's organization, whereas the Air Transport Auxiliary had men and women both flying there. And of course, the other difference was that the women of the WASP were flying in skies that were relatively safe. They certainly had dangers of their own to face, but the women of the Air Transport Auxiliary were flying in a country that was being pretty regularly bombed. In the Soviet Union, there were women who flew in combat. I just want to throw that out there. There were women fighter pilots and bomber pilots in the Soviet Union.
And we're going to circle back to that because I understand your next book deals with the Soviet Union. But before we do that, women pilots make their way into more than one of your books. I understand you yourself are a pilot.
I am. I have a private pilot's license. I am a civil aviator. I'm not a very accomplished pilot, but I do have a license, and I've done some flying. In fact, I didn't have my license then, but I have actually flown in a small plane to Kalamazoo from Pennsylvania in my long and distant past.
Tell us a little bit about how you grew up, how you became a writer.
Well, I was born in New York City, and my father worked for the New York City Board of Education, and he was sent to England when I was three to do teacher training there. He was actually organizing the Head Start program there. And we lived in England for 2 years, and I started school there. And when I was five, he was sent to Jamaica to do the same thing in Kingston, Jamaica. And we lived in Jamaica for 3 years. So I don't really remember living in the USA until I was 9 years old. And I started school in Pennsylvania. I was pretty well traveled, you know, by the time I was out of elementary school, and I haven't really stopped. I spent a semester in London when I was in college and made a lot of friends there and ended up going back and forth and eventually married an Englishman who eventually got a job in Scotland, which is where I live now. And I've now lived in the United Kingdom longer than I have lived in the United States. I've been here since 1995, and I've been in Scotland for 18 years. I met a dog walker when I was out on a walk the other day, and he said, "Oh, your accent's not from around here." I said, "No, I'm from Pennsylvania." And he said, "Oh, how long have you lived here?" And I told him I've been here 18 years. And he said, "Well, you're Scottish now."
And that's something that your characters do, too. One of the characters in your novel, they keep calling her an English woman, and she keeps correcting them to say that she's from Scotland.
Well, I was unaware that this was such a definite distinction until I moved here. And I think it's a very easy mistake to make. But England and Scotland are not the same country. It kind of has the same effect if you call a Scotsman English. It kind of has the same effect as if you call a Canadian American. They really don't like it.
You mentioned the Soviet Union before. Let's talk about what you're working on now.
I'm working on a nonfiction middle grade book called A Thousand Sisters, and it is about these women that I mentioned who flew as combat pilots for the Soviet Union in World War II. There was really one woman who kind of pulled it all together and made it happen, and her name was Marina Raskova. And she got permission to form these three women's regiments. One of them was night bombers, one was dive bombers, and the other were fighter pilots. They flew an amazing number of combat missions, the dive bombers in particular. They were doing these really short bombing runs that maybe half an hour's flight. And so they would do like 10 of these a night, and they would fly out to the front line on the Eastern Front and just harass the Germans by bombing their depots and bombing their troops and their supplies and not allowing them a night's sleep. And by the end of the war, the women who flew for this regiment had each clocked up something like 800 missions.
Wow.
You know, to 1,000 missions during the war, which is astonishing. And you compare it to the Western Allies in the United Kingdom, once you'd flown 30 bombing missions, you were retired. You didn't have to do more than 30, and these women were flying like hundreds and hundreds of them. It's incredible.
We don't hear enough about that sort of a thing.
No, we don't. We don't. And every now and then, I mean, these women are, their generation is passing away. They are in their 90s if they're still alive. And every now and then you get an obituary for one of them in, you know, the New York Times or some other, you know, very recognizable newspaper. And people go, oh, my gosh, who are these people? There was a story about them on NPR a couple of years ago because they're just so fascinating.
Yeah. I hope somebody's capturing the oral histories of these women before they're all gone.
We're very lucky because their oral histories have actually been captured on several occasions. There's an astonishing amount of information from them. There was one American woman whose name was Anna Nagel, and she had been a WASP, one of the women's air service pilots. Anne, not Anna. And she went and interviewed a whole bunch of these women in the 1990s when, you know, they were in their 70s rather than in their 90s, took all their photographs, which I think is a really charming thing. So there are also, there are Russian women who have done the same thing. And we have really a wealth of their oral histories still.
Well, let's wind this up with where we should have probably begun, with Commutine. this program that you've gotten involved in. How did that happen, and what does it mean for you?
Well, I don't know what made the ball start rolling in the first place. They contacted me, and they have an author come in every year, and they have a community of high school that read a book by their chosen author, and they read it together as, you know, a sort of a cross community mm-hmm. book group, and then the author that they've chosen comes in and talks to them and answers their questions, and you know, it's a real pleasure for me as an author to be asked to do something like this, because first of all, you get to reach out to your target audience, which I always think is wonderful, you know, being able to talk to teens who have actually read this book. And of course, the other thing that's really gratifying is just having people read your book and have questions about it. And you know, some of them like it, some of them don't. But it's always fascinating to hear what people have to say.
Will you be coming to Portage, Kalamazoo, to talk to these students?
I will be traveling to Portage and speaking in to all the schools, which will be gathered in one place. And I believe mm-hmm. there's also an evening open to the public as well.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk with us, Elizabeth. Appreciate it.
It's a real pleasure.